It's Wednesday, March the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the House Intelligence Committee will look into Russian interference in last year's election.
Russia hacking, Russian involvement in our election process, very serious questions that this investigation will try to get to the bottom of all of them.
WikiLeaks dumps a huge cache of what it says is the CIA's entire hacking capacity. Republicans squabble over health care. It's International Women's Day. We'll have a look at how some women are marking it. A documentary looks at the Oklahoma City bombing. And what's the future of the circus? It might be brighter than you think. That's all coming up on International Edition. The House Intelligence Committee says it will probe Russian interference into the U.S. election in public for the first time during a hearing March 20th. The committee chair, Representative Devin Nunes, announced that move on Tuesday. Among those invited to give public testimony are James Comey, the current director of the FBI, who has been at the center of the controversy regarding his involvement in influencing the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, Mike Rogers, who is the director of national security, and John Brennan, the former CIA director, have also been invited. Representative Nunes said on Tuesday that he has not seen any evidence to back President Donald Trump's claim that the Obama administration wiretapped him during the 2016 campaign and suggested the news media were taking the president's weekend tweets too literally.
I think the point of, if I'm understanding the point of them, was he's asking a question about whether or not he was being was he or any of his associates targeted? And I think that, I think it's a valid question, if indeed it was a question, that if you look at General Flynn, why was he being recorded? Was it incidental collection like we all assume, or was it something else? And was there any other additional incidental recordings of phone calls?
Fired National Security Advisor Michael Flynn is also invited to attend the hearing, but was not included in the list of witnesses considered to have direct information on the investigation. President Trump himself heightened the firestorm surrounding the investigation when late last week he tweeted that phones at his New York high-rise building had been wiretapped at the behest of former President Barack Obama. That's a charge that has been labeled simply false by an Obama spokesman. Top former Obama administration officials have refuted Trump's claims. Trump asked Nunes' committee and the other congressional committees investigating Russia's interference in the 2016 election to look into the matter. Representative Nunes said his committee will look into it because the charges being leveled are very serious.
Look, these are all very serious questions. I mean, you all know that we have questions about these names that continue to appear in press reports because they do involve, supposedly, Russia hacking, Russian involvement in our election process, very serious questions that this investigation will try to get to the bottom of all of them.
A Justice Department nominee who would oversee a federal investigation of Russian meddling into last year's election declined to commit to appointing a special prosecutor to probe contacts between Moscow and President Trump's inner circle. U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein, tapped by the president to serve as deputy U.S. Attorney General, told a Senate panel Tuesday he would have to examine the case before making a determination, but that he would be willing to appoint a special counsel whenever one is appropriate.
With regard to the special counsel in this or other cases, I know this is the issue du jour on Capitol Hill, but I anticipate that if I were the Deputy Attorney General, we'd have a lot of matters coming before the department over time, and I would approach them all the same way. I would evaluate the facts and the law, consider the applicable regulations, consult with career professionals in the department, and then exercise my best judgment if I were acting Attorney General, or provide my best advice to the Attorney General if he were not recused about what I believe is the right course of action.
Last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, a close Trump confidant, recused himself from the Russia probe after news broke that he had met with Russia's ambassador to the United States late last year. In such situations, the task of overseeing an investigation falls to the Deputy Attorney General, a post Rosenstein would assume if confirmed by the Senate. Taking a look now at some of the other top stories in the world, U.S. missile launchers and other equipment needed to set up a controversial missile defense system arrived in South Korea Tuesday, one day after North Korea test-fired four ballistic missiles. The U.N. Security Council on Tuesday strongly condemned the latest North Korean missile launches, calling them a grave violation of its sanctions resolutions. Former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega suffered a hemorrhage after surgery Tuesday and is in critical condition. Hundreds of hectares of land are burning in parts of four states here in the United States. Warnings have been issued for three others. And Japan's economy expanded at a slower than hoped for rate in the last quarter of 2016. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The online whistleblower group WikiLeaks on Tuesday published thousands of pages of what it described as the entire hacking capacity of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. In a statement, WikiLeaks said the CIA lost control of the majority of its hacking arsenal. I spoke with VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden about the dump, which included more than 8,700 documents.
It's going to take a while, and it's going to take a long time for people to really authenticate how much of this is real and how much isn't. Now, VOA has not been able to independently authenticate these documents, but experts we've spoken to, former security officials, intelligence officials we've spoken to, say that they look legitimate. It looks like it would be very hard to fabricate this type of volume to make it look like it's one thing when it's another, considering that the pages they've gone through, the addendums they've gone through, the attachments they've looked at, there's a consistency in how these different cyber tools are being discussed and how the whole the thought process behind it, the way some of it is almost, it's almost an internal wiki, it looks like, in where different agency employees are discussing how to go about this, how to fix these problems with these servers, or how to approach this problem, how to get information. And they say that type of consistency lends credence to the fact that this is probably real. We've also had at least one intelligence official tell us that it appears that it may have been leaked by a contractor. That's what they're looking at right now. Didn't say whether it was intentionally or unintentionally. But that would also go along with what WikiLeaks said in its press release, saying that this had been distributed among contractors, and one of them decided, according to WikiLeaks, to share it with the organization.
Now, according to some of the documents, CIA hackers discovered vulnerabilities in things like Apple's iPhone and Google Androids. Even Samsung televisions could be turned into devices to spy on people. Is that correct?
It's no one of the things that officials and security experts say is this is actually probably the least surprising or least alarming part of this document dump by WikiLeaks, because it's been well known that the U.S. intelligence agencies, other intelligence agencies, have long been looking to exploit these sort of what's called zero-day vulnerabilities, where they can go in to find these flaws in the software that runs your smartphone, that runs your smart TV, and then manipulate it without telling the companies. Now, there's going to be some controversy over this, because a lot of people say that the U.S. government shouldn't be engaging in this in some ways, and definitely shouldn't be engaging in it if it might be used to target U.S. citizens. And, you know, similar allegations about the U.S. even spying on its allies have caused, you know, dust-ups before, including when WikiLeaks released some documents, some diplomatic cables showing the U.S. had spied on German Chancellor Angela Merkel. So there's a lot of potential fallout. The fact that intelligence agencies are looking to manipulate the devices that people use to find intelligence, and the documents seem to indicate that it was foreign intelligence that they were looking for, that part, experts say, isn't at all surprising.
And I understand there's going to be an investigation by the House of Representatives to find out how this all happened?
Well, the House Intelligence Committee has already been tasked with looking into this bigger picture of what happened with the 2016 election, the allegation, well, the conclusions by the U.S. Intelligence Committee that Russia was involved in some of the hacking of DNC emails and other groups and tried to influence the election. And on Tuesday, the committee chairman said this is something that they could include into their very wide-ranging investigation. What else is going on? What is the bigger picture? What are the dots that haven't been connected yet? So it's possible the House committee will and the investigation that they're doing might get at some of that.
That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Over the strong objections of key conservatives and Democrats, House Republican leaders are forging ahead with a health care plan that scraps the major parts of the Obama-era overhaul. The House Ways and Means Committee and the Energy and Commerce Committee will convene what are expected to be marathon sessions Wednesday to start voting on the legislation. President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence back the plan to repeal Barack Obama's health care law, with the president saying that his law will do what the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, did not.
It follows the guidelines I laid out in my congressional address, a plan that will lower costs, expand choices, increase competition, and ensure health care access for all Americans. This will be a plan where you can choose your doctor. This will be a plan where you can choose your plan. And you know what the plan is? This is the plan. And we're going to have a tremendous success. It's a complicated process, but actually it's very simple. It's called good health care.
House Speaker Paul Ryan, meanwhile, says he is confident the new plan will pass the House.
Look, there are two ways of fixing health care. Have the government run it and ration it and put price controls. That's what Obamacare does. That's what the left wants. Or do what conservatives have been arguing for years. Have a vibrant free market where people get to do what they want. They buy what they want. Equalize the tax treatment. Stop the discrimination in the tax code against people who want to go out in a free marketplace and buy the health care of their choosing. This does that. This lowers costs, creates competition, it allows choices.
However, many fellow Republicans don't seem to agree with Ryan. On Tuesday, less than 24 hours after the Republican health bill was launched, a powerful conservative backlash threatened to sink it. But Oregon Representative Greg Walden, the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, said the bill's intent is to provide choices for Americans, not to throw them off the health insurance rolls.
We're going to make sure that those who have pre-existing conditions continue to get health care and health insurance. We're going to make sure that there are no lifetime caps, and we're not going to kick your kids off their plans until after they turn 26. We'll help you kick them out of the basement, maybe, but not off their health insurance. This is important work we're doing. We look forward to moving forward on it and to providing the rescue for the individual market and relief to the states and help to the people that sent us here to get this job done.
Republicans are pushing forward, even without official estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, on the cost of the bill and how many people would be covered, although GOP lawmakers acknowledge they can't hope to match the 20 million Americans covered under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Today is International Women's Day, and across the world, a variety of activities are planned, including a Day Without a Woman strike here in the United States. As VOA's Aru Pandey tells us, some women see the strike as a way to protest the Trump administration, while others see it as furthering a sense of women as victims.
Few can forget the images from January 21st, as tens of thousands of women rallied in the U.S. Capitol the day after President Donald Trump's inauguration, demanding equal opportunities. For mother of two, Vanessa Cardenas, the march was just the beginning in highlighting the ongoing struggle for women.
I think that women in the United States have come a long way, but still, we still haven't broken those big barriers, whether it's becoming the first president of the United States, or having equal pay, or, for example, making sure that we can, you know, we have control of our own bodies, because we still have those fights today.
While women across the world are encouraged to take Wednesday off from paid and unpaid labor to showcase their economic power, Cardenas says she will shop at a woman-owned business to show her support, but will still be at work here at Emily's List, which helps get more Democratic pro-choice women into elected office. Karen Agnes, founder of the conservative women's group Network of Enlightened Women, agrees on the need for gender equality, but she says Wednesday's strike excludes women like herself and sends the wrong message.
Women have made great gains, and it's frustrating for me as a young woman that the women's movement today really see women as victims still and as a victim class in need of the government to fix their problems.
No one could predict the massive crowds of women that showed up for January's march. It's hard to tell just how many will send the same message by not showing up for work on Wednesday. Arup Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, a new documentary looks at the Oklahoma City bombing, and the greatest show on earth might be closing, but circus arts are thriving. You're listening to VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The Oklahoma City bombing 22 years ago was an act of domestic terror by Gulf War veteran Timothy McVeigh and his accomplice, Terry Nichols. The bombing destroyed the Murrah Federal Building. It killed 168 people and injured 680 others. As VOA's Penelope Pulu tells us, in his documentary Oklahoma City, filmmaker Barrack Goodman revisits the bombing as the first major domestic terrorist attack in the United States on April 19th, 1995.
About a third of the building has been blown away.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on defenseless citizens.
Barrack Goodman's documentary, Oklahoma City, treats the bombing of the Murrah Center as a springboard to analyze the makeup of American homegrown terrorism.
It goes all the way back to the beginning, the founding of the Republic. This sort of, the Republic was founded on a suspicion of government.
Goodman says many of these separatists are white supremacists, and most support the unregulated right to keep and bear arms to protect themselves from outsiders and the government. In the documentary, Kerry Noble, a former militia member, encapsulates the ideology.
The government is an enemy of the people. And in this war, it's an all or nothing. You know, we either going to win as the white race or we're going to lose.
Goodman's documentary points to two events that bolstered separatist ideologies in the late 20th century. The Ruby Ridge incident on August 21st, 1992, and the two-month siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas in 1993.
You're next! You're next! Wake up and understand! You're next!
The deadly incidents were fueled by local and federal demands to search the premises for illegal firearms. The Waco siege was particularly deadly. The compound belonged to the Branch Davidian sect, led by David Koresh.
You went back on your word.
That is a lie.
When federal agents tried using force to end the siege, fire engulfed the compound, killing 82 people, including David Koresh. 62 of them were women and children.
Just arrived today.
Timothy McVeigh, a Gulf War veteran, was among those who went to witness the siege. According to the documentary, McVeigh was radicalized by those events and by a book titled the Turner Diaries.
It's a racist screed. Intriguingly, though, it describes the bombing of the FBI. It's the kind of culmination of the novel, and it really lays out a recipe for how to build a bomb like this. And it's a bomb very, very close to the one that McVeigh used. McVeigh was a shock to most people in the FBI and so on. It would be less of a shock today. But it's very hard to prevent these things. One of the takeaways from our film, an audience who have seen it have been amazed at how really easy it was to do this. It cost about $6,000. It was one guy reading some literature.
Goodman says in a politically polarized America, the possibility for future domestic terrorist attacks is high.
And if you talk to people like the Southern Poverty Law Center, who tracks these groups, they're pounding on the wall, they're ringing the bell, they're saying this is an ongoing threat. It's threat level midnight. It's rising. You know, it's whatever the highest color is on the chart.
He hopes his film will call attention to this rising threat and continue to the conversation on the inherent dangers of domestic terrorism. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
For generations, the circus meant big entertainment, elephants, lion tamers, dancing bears, high wire acts. But times and tastes have changed. In May, after nearly a century and a half, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, the so-called greatest show on earth, will close. But as Jeff London tells us now, there are other places where circus is alive and well and drawing audiences.
Adam Woolley ran away to join the circus. Well, actually, he decided to pursue a circus career after seeing Cirque du Soleil. Today, he runs Circus Now, a nonprofit organization which supports and promotes the circus arts.
Circus artists have been producing new and incredible circus acts and apparatuses and shows that have an artistic context and theatrical storylines or well-drawn characters. And this has been happening around the world for the past 10, 15 years or so.
One of those troupes is the Racehorse Company from Finland. Acrobat Rauli Kosonen formed it with a couple of other performers 9 years ago because he says there's something unique about circus.
I think it's really pure art form, in the sense that you can really feel the risks. There's a lot of risks, so you can get a lot of adrenaline when you watch it. If there is kind of tricks that make your heart bounce because it's real, they can see that if they make a mistake, they might get hurt. So I guess that's always been why circus is appealing. It reminds us that we are humans.
And Kosonen, whose specialty is trampoline, has the broken bones to prove it.
Well, I had 3 operations, then it's part of the job. Sometimes you don't get lucky.
Here in the U.S., smaller traditional troupes like the Kelly Miller Circus still pitch their tents across the country. But Adam Woolley says there are more experimental companies that are pushing the art form.
Audiences or families who might not be interested to go see some very avant-garde modern dance will still go see the circus. You know, people who would prefer to watch movies or television than go see a play will probably still come see the circus.
We sometimes shy away from calling ourselves circus.
Kendall Riley is one of the founders of New York's only child aerial theater.
Just because there is the implication that the skills or the spectacle is sort of paramount rather than the narrative. And we really have tried to keep the narrative the most important element and have the skills really drive and support the narrative.
In a former factory in Brooklyn, Only Child is rehearsing its latest show, Asylum. It's set in a mental institution in the 1970s. There's a story, but there's no spoken dialogue, says co-founder Nikki Miller.
We would describe it as a theater piece that includes a lot of aerial work, dance, some recorded music, some live music, an overhead projection and shadow. So the story is told rather than through dialogue, through the conversation of all of those theatrical vocabularies instead.
So So even as the performers do aerial tricks, they're dressed like mental patients, doctors, and nurses, says Riley.
You know, there's no sparkles, there's no spandex.
But they're still doing stuff high off the ground, without a net. Circus Now's Adam Woolley says the only child in racehorse companies with their different skill sets and artistic approaches all fall under the big tent of what circus can be. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The late Marvin Gaye had a hit song that included the words, "When I get that feeling, I need sexual healing." It turns out the secret to better job satisfaction may be as easy as taking Marvin Gaye's advice and having a healthy sex life. According to researchers at Oregon State University, married employees who prioritized sex at home were better workers and enjoyed their jobs more. On the other hand, the research showed that people who bring work-related stress home impinged on employees' sex lives, and that led researchers to recommend leaving work at the office. For their study, the researchers followed 159 married employees for 2 weeks and had them fill out 2 brief questionnaires each day. Those who had sex reported better moods the next day, particularly in the morning, which allowed them to be more engaged. The reason that sex helps workers enjoy more work more, that is that it releases 2 hormones, dopamine and oxytocin, both of which are mood enhancers, the effects of which can last into the next day. They added that the effects can last for at least 24 hours and worked equally well among men and women. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is in the midst of its most severe drug epidemic since the 1980s. Nonetheless, the country is positioning itself within the international system to fight it, thanks to close cooperation with its international partners and with mechanisms created over the past decades to fight drug trafficking, said Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs William Brownfield. He spoke at a press conference to introduce the congressionally mandated 2017 International Narcotics Control Strategy Report, submitted annually by the State Department. The report describes the efforts of key countries to attack all aspects of the international drug trade. This year's report, said Assistant Secretary Brownfield, is a story of 40 years of building capabilities, intelligence, coordination, specialized units, new laws, and relationships around the world. So, for example, the United States and Mexico have developed cooperative mechanisms, coordination, joint operations, and intelligence sharing that have improved the ability of both countries to address the issue of drug trafficking across the U.S.-Mexico border. We are better positioned to deal with it today, as this annual report demonstrates, because we have mechanisms cooperation, said Assistant Secretary Brownfield. We have regional groupings. We have equipment and technology. We have specialized units. We have legislation and statutes on the books in more than 100 different countries that allow us to address the issue internationally, multinationally, regionally, and bilaterally among governments. It is much better that we are confronting this situation, this historic opioid crisis today, with the architecture that we have in place now than it would have been 20 years ago, he said. I believe we have a good strategy. I believe this international drug report lays out a good global architecture for more than 100 nations of the world to cooperate and work together to address the drug issue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for, what's the uni-